PGI, please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning and thank you for joining Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded, April the 3rd, 2014. I would now like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Professor Philip Siddle. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks, Eileen. Thanks, Rachel, for inviting me to speak this morning. It's great to be able to speak about this topic, which I've probably come to quite late in terms of my interest. My background, as you can see on the slide, is I work in the pain management service at Greenwich Hospital in Sydney. And from pain management perspective, we don't really put a lot of emphasis on spirituality, and I'll talk about that as we go through the lecture. Of course, I realise that I'm speaking to a palliative care audience, and for them, spirituality is really something that's, I think, in some quarters is almost taken for granted. Palliative care has a long history of taking spirituality as part of assessment and treatment. Whereas for pain management, this is really something new. So what I'd like to look at this morning is where we've come from in terms of pain management. What are the sort of conceptual approaches that we use to treating pain historically, and where does that lead to in terms of spirituality and its involvement in pain medicine? So before I start, I'd just like to acknowledge the other members of my team, Rebecca McCabe, our physiotherapist, who's been involved in some of this research, Mandy Corbett, who's a researcher on our team, and Robin Murray, our clinical psychologist. And also I'm very fortunate to work with two great palliative care physicians, Melanie Lovell and Rod McLeod, who we've stolen from New Zealand, very fortunately for us. And also just to acknowledge the funding that we've got, Hammond Care has been very supportive of our work. And also we've had funding support from the Australian and New Zealand College of Anaesthetists. And so if I go back in terms of pain and how we've seen it sort of conceptually, this is the, I guess, the traditional view of pain is very much a biological experience. And I'm on slide 3 now. And this is a sort of Cartesian view where Descartes, even though he wasn't a pain physician, obviously had a lot of interest in different areas, actually proposed how pain might work. And so his sort of suggestion was that we have some sort of signal generator, and this drawing that he put forward shows it as a fire. And what that's doing is that it's stimulating some pain fibers. He thought it was some sort of tube that conveys messages up the spinal cord. And he proposed that somewhere in the brain there was a sort of a signal receiver, something that was a bit like we'd call today our auditory cortex or our visual cortex. There was some sort of area in the brain that was involved in the experience of pain that then registered those messages and gave us the experience of pain. And so for a long time, really into the 20th century, that Cartesian view of pain was very dominant. And at the sort of extreme end in terms of pain management, it led to sort of the surgical approach to pain, whereas if somebody had pain, there was a pathway, and simply by cutting the pathway, you disconnected the source of the pain from the brain and stopped pain. And so, for example, for cancer, using things such as cordectomy, so cutting the spinal cord and basically disconnecting the pain from the brain. And for palliative care, that can actually work reasonably well sometimes. I mean, in extreme circumstances, cordectomies, cordotomies can be done and can be useful. But the problem is particularly for the non-cancer population, people that we're seeing with ongoing pain. People then developed ongoing neuropathic pain syndrome. So it soon became clear that simply seeing pain as a sort of a telegraph wire experience, where there are messages that go along and if you cut the telegraph wires you can disconnect the pain, is really not an adequate view of pain. And this is a more recent diagram. So the first one is a few hundred years ago. This one's much more recent. But in a sense, even though it sort of brings together our understanding of anatomy and physiology, at looking at some of these pathways from the periphery through the spinal cord up into the brain stem, midbrain, connections between the thalamus and the cortex, even though there's a bit more detail, in a sense, it's not that far along from the Cartesian model. It's still very much, we have these wires that are transmitting information, and you could still get the perception from that sort of diagram that if you cut these lines somewhere along the process, that you can treat pain. So in this view, pain is very much a signal of biological damage. And I'm now onto slide 5. And so the typical sort of pain situations, appendicitis, osteoarthritis, renal calculi, herpes zoster, fractured femur, all of these are sort of that traditional view of pain. Somewhere in the body we have a stimulus, pathology, which is stimulating receptors, which are then being activated, transmitting information along to the spinal cord and up to the brain, and then we experience pain. And that sort of model of pain as a signal of biological damage still fits very much within that Cartesian model. The problem, and people, of course, had observed these sort of things for many years, and I've moved on to slide 6, is that there are many situations where that sort of traditional Cartesian view of pain just doesn't stack up. And so particularly, even during the American Civil War, but particularly in the World War II, there are a number of clinicians who reported these observations of people who had sometimes horrific wounds in first aid stations in battle, and yet came back to the base camp reporting very little pain. And similarly, moving on to slide 7, this sort of situation where somebody going back to the Cartesian view of pain, they have a very adequate noxious stimulus. This guy's got something sticking through his side, and yet when you look at his face, there is sort of a disconnect between what should be an adequate stimulus. We assume all those pathways are intact going up the spinal cord into the brain, but there's no registration of pain in terms of his face. So the Cartesian view really struggles to explain why is it that people can go through these situations. How can they have this very strong nociceptive stimulus and yet not seem to experience pain either by the way that they look or in the battle situation, even when people are saying, no, I don't really have any pain or much pain at all. And moving on to slide 8, one of the big things that changed our view of pain was the gait theory was published just almost now 50 years ago, where Melzack and Wall, so Melzack being a clinical psychologist and Wall being a physiologist, put forward this sort of still quite mechanistic view, but still bringing together not just the transmission of information through the spinal cord, but an interaction between firstly different fibre types. So they proposed that large fibres interact with small fibres. So large fibres come in. This is all happening in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord, and there are transmission cells that transmit information towards the brain, and these smaller SGs, substantia gelatinosa, the cells in the dorsal horn, these smaller cells are inhibitory, and inhibitory cells can either be activated by large fibres or inhibited by small fibres transmitting nociceptive, painful information. And activation of those inhibitory fibres, if they're activated by large fibres, they reduce the amount of information going through, and if they're activated by small fibres, they increase the amount of information going through. So for the first time, it gave a sort of a physiological explanation for why there are differences in the way that people experience pain. And it sort of explained the sort of very simple observation that, you know, if you have pain, if you hit yourself on the hand with a hammer accidentally, your instinctive reaction is to rub that area. And so by activating large fibres, by rubbing, that's increasing information in these inhibitory cells, which is blocking the amount of information coming through from small fibres and transmitting pain. So that was one thing, is that this interaction between large and small fibres in the dorsal horn and the spinal cord. But possibly more important was this central control. What they proposed was that there are central control mechanisms coming down from the brain that also control the amount of information coming through. So not only an interaction between fibres, but there is a possibility that the brain can modify the amount of information coming through. So that helped to sort of physiologically understand again why there's this big discrepancy sometimes between what you think is the information coming through from the periphery and what seems to be received by the brain. So changes in psychology, fear, anxiety, excitement, all of those sort of states are changing central controls, sending messages down somehow and controlling the gate so there is more or less information going through. And that can be either way. It can be in some situations opening the gate and causing, so for example, anxiety might increase, open the gate and increase information. Other situations, excitement can close the gate, reduce information and reduce the amount of pain. So it's really a huge step forward in terms of trying to put together the difference in perception of pain depending on the amount of information going through, and radically changed our view of pain. So in essence, really then, there's a signal generator which is triggering pain. There's an amplifier in the spinal cord which is modulating either up or down the amount of information going through. And there are these descending controls from the brain that are controlling the amplifier and, again, how much information is going up. So moving on to slide 9, more recently this has flowed through to experiments, and things such as functional brain imaging have been fantastic in terms of exploring some of these psychological processes that are involved in pain perception. And this is just one, but shows the response related to expectation. And what you can see is that in this situation, people are told what sort of pain to expect. So here they've been told that they're going to be given a stimulus, which is 50 degrees, and that is likely to be painful. And then sometime later, then they're actually given the stimulus, which was 50 degrees. And this is doing functional MRI, and what you can see is that in these, this average of people involved in the experiment, there is activation of these areas which we know are involved in pain perception. Then the next time, what they did was to lower their expectations. So they said, this time we're going to reduce the amount of the stimulus, we're going to reduce it down to 48. But then they actually tricked them and delivered a 50-degree stimulus. And as you can see between the difference with those two sets of slides, in the first group, there is much stronger activation in these brain areas involved in pain than the second one. So stimulus, exactly the same, both 50 degrees, but changing the expectation from 50 degrees, it's not a huge difference, 50 down to 48, there is actually less activation of these brain areas involved in pain. So by simply telling somebody that you're going to expect less pain, their anticipation, expectation changes, actually changes physiologically the pain experience in the brain. And then just to follow through, they then told them it was going to be 48 degrees, but in effect they still gave them 48 degrees and it was lower still. So functional MRI has been hugely beneficial in terms of understanding some of these psychological processes, and to sort of flesh out the concepts that Melzack and Wall put forward as the gate control theory. So for the first time, we can see physiologically some of these changes that are happening that are part of this descending control from the brain down to the spinal cord. And as an sort of an example of this on slide 10, this is a guy who's a trained yogi. So in terms of normal experience, he's probably one end of the spectrum in terms of training, but it shows the effect of meditation. So this is somebody who's trained to do meditation for hours a day. And in this situation, what they did was to put this spike through his tongue, which which looks a bit extreme, but was a way of looking at pain responses. They then measured EEG activity in the brain and found that there was a virtually no response to that stimulus through his tongue. So simply by training using meditation, changing the way that the brain responds, you can not only reduce the experience of pain, and clearly he doesn't look, I think I would be wincing a lot more than that with something like that going on, and also no brain activation associated with pain. So it takes a step forward to looking at not only the experimental situation, but even though we wouldn't be doing this in the clinic or doing it ourselves, it sort of shows the possibilities in terms of being able to control the response to pain and also to control what's happening in our brains. So this sort of concept was that pain is a biopsychological experience rather than a simply biological experience, which is really the Cartesian view, was that pain has not only a biological factor, so signals being generated, being transmitted up towards the brain, but other factors such as observation, empathy, activate these descending controls, which Melzack and Wall had proposed. These go down pathways, and these pathways have been shown, that connect with the spinal cord and the dorsal horn, change the amplifier, again, either up or down, and modify the amount of experience going up so that there was no simple relationship between messages coming in and what goes to the brain, that the amount of perception would modify, and so there's no longer a strict relationship between messages coming in and pain perception. So all of these factors, observation, empathy, expectation, anticipation, attention, all of these would modify the pain experience. So moving on to slide 12, the other very important figure was Engel. And this is not just related to pain, but generally through health and medicine. Engel proposed that any sort of health experience really is a biopsychosocial experience. And so he suggested that pain, including all sorts of other conditions, needed to be seen within a social context. So our experiences, our work, our relationships, our culture, all of these sort of contextual issues have an influence on our psychological state, our cognitions, our mood, and therefore have the ability to change psychologically and biologically the way that we experience pain. So all of these factors that we've just looked at in terms of the biopsychological experience then influence the way that we experience pain. So that means that if you experience pain in this sort of situation, or this sort of situation, this sort of situation, or this one, all of these have some element of a nociceptive. If you're looking at it as purely a biological experience, there is a nociceptive, a clear nociceptive component to what's going on. And yet the experience of pain across all of these is quite different. In these upper situations, certainly in this one, it looks as though there is certainly it's behavioural suggestions that's a strong painful element. And this one, I'm guessing there's also a strong pain experience. But these bottom ones, there is a strong mismatch between the likely nociception that's going on, and simply because of the context, what's going on around them, the situation, this guy winning, this person in a very cultural sort of situation, there's this strong mismatch between the information going in that's generating nociception and their pain experience. So moving on then, and that's largely looking at pain as a biopsychosocial experience, but Cicely Saunders, who of course is very well known in palliative care circles, took the biopsychosocial one step further to include the spiritual. And I'm sure many of you are aware of this sort of model that she put forward, that pain has physical aspects, so it must include other symptoms, there are side effects, there's other factors that become important such as insomnia and fatigue. There is the psychological experience, so anger, towards the illness itself or sometimes as professionals involved in care. There's the disfigurement associated that's often part of the pain experience or the cancer experience. There is fear of pain, and particularly in the palliative care situation, of death. And what we share in the cancer and non-cancer situation is also too these feelings of helplessness and loss of control. Also the social situation, and again cancer and non-cancer pain, there's worry about family finances, there is a change in terms of job and role in the family and social position, and also isolation. But then adding into this are these other spiritual factors. And these are related, or Cicely Saunders proposed that it was related to these other sort of issues, such as these bigger sort of existential questions. Why me? Why am I going through this? Why do I have cancer? Why am I experiencing this chronic pain? What's the point? Questioning meaning behind these sort of situations. And questioning other issues such as purpose, meaning of life, and for some people that also involves a relationship with God as well. So Cicely Saunders really expanded this view, taking it beyond the biopsychosocial to say that there is other factors going, I suppose, to a deeper, for some people this is the core of who they are in terms of meaning, purpose, identity, and saying these are an incredibly important part of the experience of somebody who is going through a terminal illness, and it needs to be addressed and it needs to be looked at if we're going to treat them properly. And she was the one who came up with this concept of total pain, of bringing all these factors together as part of the pain experience, and how important it was to examine them, to address them as part of care. And once you move into spirituality, of course, the big question becomes definitions. How do we define spirituality? And it's sometimes hard to reach consensus. And as I said right at the beginning, the palliative care field is way ahead of us in terms of looking at spirituality and what it means. And there are a number of consensus statements and definitions that have been put forward, particularly in the palliative care field. And most of those relate around meaning and purpose. Some people have suggested that spirituality is around religion. And some people, when you talk about spirituality, that's the first thing they assume, is that you're talking about religion. But in fact, most people in their definitions have said that just confining to religion is inadequate. For many people, their experience of spirituality may not necessarily be related to religion. And if you ask them, they say, I'm a spiritual person, but they're not necessarily religious. So most people will take a broader definition of spirituality, which is more to do with meaning and purpose that may or may not include a religious perspective as well. And so another definition, which again is very much about meaning and purpose. So it may or may not be associated with religion, which is an expression of spiritual relief through an organized system of rituals and practices. So moving on to slide 16, and we were talking about context before, and so then the spiritual context as well as the psychosocial context becomes extremely important in terms of the pain or the cancer experience. So particularly in the pain situation, what does this pain mean? How does it affect my relationships, my friends and family? In the cancer situation, how long will I be with them? Do they see me as a failure, perhaps? Particularly in the pain where people can't work or do what they used to be able to before in terms of care for the family. For some people, there are questions around their relationship with God or a higher power. Does God care? Is God there? Is this a trial? Am I being punished? And there is actually, I'll come to later, some information about how people see this relationship in terms of experiencing pain. For people's identity, again, their role in the family, their role as a productive member of society, and for the future. And of course, in palliative care, that becomes very obvious sometimes and very immediate. But it's just as applicable in a different sort of sense in the non-cancer pain situation in terms of loss of hope. And for some people in the non-cancer situation, that can be even more devastating in a sense that they're looking ahead to this life which just doesn't seem to have any hope at all. They've lost those relationships with family and friends, inability to work, all these other sort of things, which then strip them away of any sense of hope for the future. So the biopsycho-spiritual approach then includes all of these factors. So there's the biological, the physical pain, physical limitations, the psychological, mood, depression, anxiety, anger, and also cognitions. There's the social side, so there's the impact on relationships, and also the spiritual, so issues of meaning and purpose, which seem to be the most common sort of factor that is talked about. As I mentioned, for some people that might have to do with the relationship with God, and then issues around identity and also hope. And the question then is to examine how do these interact. So there is an interaction between all of these. It's not seeing these factors in isolation, but considering each of them and thinking how do they interact within the context of pain or palliative care. So the questions around pain are, how does firstly pain impact spiritual well-being? And then conversely, how does spiritual well-being impact pain? And again, there isn't a lot of information to go on. As I've said before, in palliative care, there's been a lot more work exploring how these factors are interrelated in terms of caring for people who are facing end-of-life issues, whereas in the pain management field, there is very limited information about how these interact. So firstly, how does pain impact spiritual well-being? And we and others have been doing work, and some of you may be familiar with this scale, the FACIT spirituality scale, which is one of the most widely used questionnaires for examining spirituality. And in some ways, it's very inadequate. There are 23 items. So trying to measure in a quantitative sense an aspect such as spirituality, which of course is so broad, with a 23-item questionnaire clearly has its limitations. But this is some way of trying to understand these aspects and getting some measure of what's going on. So there is a 5-point scale that people rate each of these items on, and as you can see, what it's looking at is some of those issues that we've talked about. So peace, reason for living, sense of productiveness, peace of mind, sense of purpose, meaning and purpose again, and then also tapping into some of these issues around faith and spiritual beliefs. And then there's a second part of the questionnaire, so there's an extended, the first 12 items are the basic questionnaire, and then there's an extended questionnaire which also brings in some other, which are perhaps looser issues around spirituality in terms of connection to other people, love, feeling as though they're being loved or loving others, forgiveness, thankfulness, appreciation and hope. And this is a questionnaire that's been applied in the cancer setting for trying to assess spirituality. And as a first step for our research, one of the things was to use this questionnaire to try and compare how people with pain, what is their experience of spirituality compared with these other groups. Because it has been used in other populations but not a cancer population, can we compare what's going on? And so on slide 22, this just compares some of the information from previous published studies, so the advanced cancer, cancer with what people call spiritual pain, so they actually separated out people who identified themselves as having spiritual pain, a group of people with HIV/AIDS. And this is the sample that we did with a group of people with chronic pain. So the higher bars is the extended 23-item questionnaire, and the smaller one is the 12-item smaller FACIT questionnaire. And even though we don't have enough numbers to show statistical significance, what you can see is that even though we can't definitely say that it is lower, it is clear that the people with chronic pain have very similar levels to people with cancer and HIV/AIDS. And even though we sort of felt that spirituality using this sort of scale was likely to be impacted in pain, this was our first step to indicate that it really is just as an important issue in chronic pain, and possibly even more important in people experiencing chronic pain than these other groups of people. Even people who have cancer and identify themselves as having spiritual pain, the levels between those are very similar. So clearly, certainly using this measure of spiritual well-being, spirituality, spiritual well-being, or spiritual distress, if you want to put it the other way, is a major factor for people who are experiencing chronic pain. So that's one side of the one side of things. How does pain impact our spiritual well-being? But then the other issue is, how does spiritual well-being impact pain? And this is important in terms of moving forward with treatment. It's one thing to say that we can see that chronic pain impacts a person's spiritual well-being, but where does it leave us? We need to be able to do something about it. So does spiritual well-being itself change the way that we experience pain, either in terms of intensity or other factors? So moving on to slide 24, and as I said, there isn't a huge amount of information, but the studies that have been done do show that there is an influence. Some of these studies do tend to focus on the religious aspects of spirituality. So, for example, this one that's been shown is found that people who are more religious, and this is in terms of importance to life rather than to practice, so not measuring what they do, it's more trying to say how important it is to you in terms of the way you live your life. And they found that these people who rated themselves more highly in terms of importance had lower levels of pain, better mood, and better quality of life. And another study from Europe suggested that, in a similar sort of way, I guess, the centrality of someone's belief is a significant factor in maintaining a high level of life satisfaction in the presence of pain. So not looking at pain intensity specifically, but more looking at whether you can maintain a high level of life satisfaction even though pain may be present. And another one examining this relationship a bit more closely found that the type of experience rather than the experience itself is important. So it wasn't just whether somebody had a spiritual experience, relationship with God, but if somebody felt as though God was a punishing type of person, they had a worse pain experience than somebody who saw God as more kind, more loving, that sort of thing. So it's not, as they start to dig, it's not a straightforward relationship. It's not just whether you're religious it makes a difference. It's actually important what that sort of experience is. So as you can see, most of the studies, I guess, because of where they've come from, most of them have come from the United States, although also from Europe, but they still tend to focus on a religious experience when they're talking about spirituality. And in terms of addressing spiritual issues, there are a number of ways that have been put forward. Some of these are around addressing meaning and purpose, and usually in a sort of a counselling, psychotherapy sort of situation where people address these issues. Also stress reduction, so using techniques such as yoga, mindfulness, and mindfulness meditation has become extremely widespread, and there's a lot of data now to support its benefit in treating pain. But using other types of meditation techniques, not just mindfulness, there are of course a whole range of meditation techniques that address this sort of aspect. And then narrative and life review are very much part of palliative care and are now used fairly widely in some places to try and address these sort of spiritual issues. So reflection, looking back over life, creating a legacy, addressing issues. And from the other side, in terms of care, people have also identified other sort of factors that they feel are important in terms of spirituality. So attentive listening, kindness, compassion, gentleness, empathy, trusting relationships. People have identified these either from health caregiver perspective or the person receiving care as what they feel are important ingredients in terms of addressing or providing care that has a spiritual component. So moving on to slide 26, looking at, again, how spirituality can influence pain. And so rather than the experience, how do spiritual practices influence pain? And again, I guess because of reasons of where this research is coming from, it does often focus on a sort of more religious aspect. But this study showed that using spiritual resources results in a higher pain tolerance rather than reduced pain intensity. So not reducing the pain intensity itself, but people's ability to tolerate higher levels of pain. And very similarly, from the same research group, using meditation also increased people's tolerance. And another a study by the same group looking at a spiritual versus a secular type of meditation. So in this one, it wasn't religious. They gave them a meditation that had more of a spiritual component, but not necessarily religious, and they weren't all religious in the study. But by simply adding a spiritual component versus a very secular meditation, there was reduced frequency of migraines and pain tolerance. So all of these studies suggest that some of these spiritual practices seem to have an impact in terms of pain, although most of the information seems to be around pain tolerance rather than reducing pain intensity. And I guess to try and bring in some of these factors, we started a group pain program at Greenwich Hospital in Sydney 18 months ago, where we tried to include some of these factors within a group pain program in a very broad sort of context. So trying to address issues of meaning and purpose, not a religious way of addressing these things, to see if it made a difference in terms of addressing pain. So based on very standard sort of cognitive behavioural principles, which is the bulk of the program, but bringing in a module that looked at issues of meaning and purpose. So the program is run primarily by our physiotherapist and clinical psychologist. We have 3-hour weekly sessions, and we have 6 of those. And the content is around about pain education, talking to people about pain mechanisms, how it works, the gait theory, control mechanisms, looking at tools and skills such as relaxation, deep breathing, muscle relaxation, exercise, stretching, graded activity, pacing. And then looking at meditation, but bringing in partly borrowing on positive psychology, but trying to look at aspects, not just meditation as a relaxation, but trying to foster these other qualities of acceptance, gratitude, and courage, which other studies show are very important components of resilience, of being able to deal with difficult situations and to be able to keep going. And also, again, borrowing on palliative care area, looking at life reflection, regaining meaning and purpose in the face of pain. That's extremely difficult to do within that sort of time frame, but trying to introduce these sort of concepts. So moving on to slide 28, and this shows our outcomes to date. So this is over the last 18 months. And the strongest change that we see in terms of significance, and it's quite a strong treatment effect size, is change in pain intensity of just over a third, which was surprising for us because many CBT programs looking at chronic pain don't specifically aim to reduce pain intensity. In fact, some programs will deliberately ignore pain because they see that as reinforcing. So it's very interesting in this program that that is the strongest change that we're seeing is in pain intensity. But also perceived disability, physical function increases by 50%, almost 50% on average during the program over the 6 weeks. So they are the strongest changes, a reduction in pain intensity and improvement in physical function. But also changes in mood, cognition such as pain self-efficacy, catastrophizing, but not a big change in spirituality, only 20%. So we're not producing a major shift in terms of people's spirituality over the course of the 6 weeks. And compared with some of those other factors, even though it's not small, it's not insignificant statistically, but it's not as big as some of these other changes. And the other interesting thing is trying to compare, so moving on to slide 29, is trying to see whether spiritual well-being has any influence in terms of the outcomes that we're seeing over those 6 weeks of the program. And so what we examined was the levels of spiritual well-being and these other factors such as satisfaction with life, catastrophizing, pain, self-efficacy, looking at these at baseline and then looking at how that correlates with changes in pain intensity during the program. So is there a relationship between pain reduction during the program and some of these factors when people come into the, when they start the program? And so a very interesting result for us in terms of relationship between spiritual well-being and what's happening during the program is that, as you can see here, is that spiritual well-being actually had the strongest correlation between, it was the strongest predictor in a sense of pain relief. So people who started the program with high levels of spiritual well-being were most likely to have a large pain reduction during the program. Now, the reasons for this, we don't know. We don't know whether it's something about those people, whether that's the program particularly appeals, or whether people who come in with high levels of spiritual well-being relate to things in the program more or are more likely to get engaged with the program. We're not sure why that relationship is there. But it's, in some senses, surprising. We weren't expecting that. But also interesting that there is this strong relationship between spiritual well-being and the likelihood of doing well. And just to illustrate this, I thought I'd mention two people who came through the program just to talk in terms of, I suppose, a tale of two spiritualities. And firstly, Bruce, who's a 63-year-old retired army officer, a 20-year history of pain in the neck and low back, multiple falls and incidents, high levels of pain, not on huge doses of medications, limited activities, changes in mood, depression, anxiety, anger, some PTSD symptoms as well, pain affecting his relationship with his wife, and also affecting, he didn't regard himself as a spiritual person, losing hope and loss of identity, and changes in his spine on imaging. And then comparing with Mary, who is a 61-year-old woman, 4-year history of pain in the low back and both legs, no clear incident or trauma, high levels of pain, again, not on huge doses of medications, not as much impact on physical activities and little impact on mood, but sees herself very much as a spiritual person, belongs to a religious order, attends numerous retreats and meditates, and has some degenerative changes in the spine. And when you look at their results, what you can see is that Bruce scores very lowly in terms of spirituality. This is the cancer averages, our own averages, which are lower than the cancer population, and he is lower than even our own group. But that has increased. This is post following the program. And satisfaction with life has also increased, whereas Mary came in with very high levels of spiritual well-being, and these didn't change much over the program. And then when you look at the outcomes, the DAS is depression and anxiety. Bruce started with high levels of depression, which dropped following the program, whereas Mary lower levels to start, and so they didn't change much. And his levels of pain intensity were high at the start and didn't change, whereas Mary's reduced over the course of the program. So to sort of summarise, both came in with high pain. Bruce had low spiritual well-being, Mary had high. He had low self-efficacy, Mary had high. High levels of catastrophizing versus low, pain program, no change in pain versus large reduction, improvements in catastrophizing and self-efficacy, some improvement because they're already at high levels, and improved depression, anxiety, minimal depression, improved function on both sides, but both of them having high or increased satisfaction with life. So to try and bring these things together, spiritual distress is a major contributor to suffering. Pain, we know, has a major impact on spiritual well-being. There is a poor relationship between spiritual well-being and pain intensity. Spiritual well-being seems to increase satisfaction with life despite the presence of pain, so it seems to be related to issues such as resilience. And I just want to finish by looking at, lastly, from the carer's service deliverer, the perspective. And I came across this article just a week ago, which was interesting in terms of the title, because the title that I put in for this talk was The Intersection Between Spirituality and Pain, and this was the title of this paragraph that I came across. And it's looking at the carer's perspective, that patients learn to cope with and understand their suffering through their spiritual beliefs or the spiritual dimension of their lives. It's also through that dimension that the compassionate, caring part of the doctor-patient relationship is enacted. What has happened over the last 30 years is that science has really led medicine, and a lot of the non-technical aspects of medicine have been neglected. The spiritual assessment brings us back to those compassionate, caregiving roots of the patient-doctor relationship. When you get involved in the discussion with a patient about his or her spirituality, you enter the domain of what gives that person meaning or purpose. And she goes on to explain it. Of course, it's not just the doctor-patient relationship. She qualifies in that and says it's any person who's involved in caring for somebody, and she's talking about cancer in this situation, is that it brings another dimension to the relationship between the person caring for somebody with cancer or pain and the person who's receiving that care. And so spirituality is not just about the person and their experience of cancer or pain, but actually changes the dynamic and the dimensions of the interaction between people who are being cared for. So finishing thoughts, spirituality is about meaning, purpose, identity, hope. All of these are significant contributors to pain and suffering more generally. How do we bring hope to people who face the end of the life, which of course is more in the palliative care situation, but for us, in more the chronic non-cancer situation, a life that will always include pain. And as I finished off with, it's also about our relationship, I think, with the people that we're caring for, that spirituality can also bring an added dimension for the health professional. So it's broad across all of these different aspects of caring for people, the way that it affects their experience of pain, and also the relationship in the healthcare setting. So I'll finish off there.